Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Mary Chalk and Lisa Lanoz. Mary has written, "I've always been a nature lover. Living on Nantucket, the beloved critically endangered North Atlantic right whales have been part of my life, as it is for all those who live on the island. I became aware in 2019 of a proposal to transform one of the whales' last nursery and feeding sites into the nation's first, largest in the world offshore wind array of 1,400 turbines. I became alarmed to learn the developers were given a special permit to interfere with the whales' basic behaviors when necessary during construction. Our government permitting agencies also intend to use this first array as a test bed on the whales and ecosystem to establish regulation of the industry going forward. I formed Cape and Islands Wildlife Conservation Alliance to spread awareness and engage those who wish to stop the projects until adequate studies and steps are in place before construction to save these magnificent whales from extinction." And Lisa Lanoz resides in rural New Hampshire and has been a leading figure in the wind energy debate for nearly two decades. She serves as executive director of the Wind Action Group. That's two words. Wind Action is one word. Group is a second word. A national advocacy focused on the impact and policy issues associated with industrial wind energy development. Lisa has testified before Congress on environmental issues, and she's held elected and volunteer positions in community planning and land negotiation. So first off, thank you, both of you, for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks, Derek.
Thank you, Derek. Thanks for having us.
So let's start. You know, we started with North Atlantic right whales by mentioning them. So can you tell us a little bit about who they are, give an introduction to them and to their I don't think desperate plight is too strong.
No, it isn't too strong a word. Well, I live on Nantucket Island, and the waters off our island and our island itself are historically known for whale breeding areas, nursery areas. Our history is based on the whales here because of the whaling industry. And the right whale, the North Atlantic right whale, was called the right whale because it was a right whale to kill for their oil in the 1700s. And which they were once abundant in these waters, but the whaling industry nearly decimated them to less than 100. And since then, they've been protected, and they are trying to recover. And a few years ago, when I got started on this in 2019, the numbers had recovered to about 450. It's very slow recovery. But since 2017, they are involved in an unusual mortality event, which is due to human activity of vessel strikes and gear entanglement. And so since 2019, their numbers have plummeted to 336 whales, North Atlantic right whales, on the entire planet. But the real critical number is that there are less than 70 breeding females left on the entire planet. And so they are on a path to extinction. And as I said, the leading cause of death are vessel strikes and gear entanglement. They are now found in our waters south of the island every month of the year. One third of the population is found, of the entire population, uses the area. About half of the breeding females capable of giving birth are found in the area in every month of the year as well. And so ironically, in 2019, I learned that the wind farm, the largest in the world, first in the nation, is to be constructed in the heart of this critically endangered right whale habitat. And that's when I started getting involved, because, you know, we have conservation groups that come here regularly and teach us about this whale and all of the protections. Where, you know, we all celebrate when a calf is born, and we all get very sad when one is hit by a vessel and beaches itself and dies. And so I went to this public hearing. I saw that, you know, this construction was proposed with pile driving and, you know, filling the area with construction vessels. And I asked if they had done impact studies to determine, conclude their finding of insignificant impacts. And they said yes, which I found out they hadn't. And so they've also, I was also alarmed that they were given something called an incidental take authorization, which gives the developers permission to harass, potentially injure the whale during the construction activities. They have very sensitive hearing, and the pile driving needed to install the turbines will fill the ocean with deafening noise. And also the vessel strikes. These whales live within 30 feet of the ocean surface, so they're very vulnerable to vessel strikes. And so I just became very alarmed. I found some people on the group to work with and found Lisa and, you know, join Save Right Whales Coalition. I guess just trying to spread awareness at this point. The most alarming thing is that they are acknowledging this will serve as a test bed for the first in the nation offshore wind industrial installation. And this is a critically endangered species. And that listing obligates us to not only protect these whales, but to also aid in their recovery. And I guess that's about it, Derek.
So before we move on, I have a couple more questions. One of them would be, can you said that their recovery is very slow, and do they normally have a single calf or do they have twins? And then second, how often do they have babies? And third, do they normally go, I don't know anything about North Atlantic right whales. Do they normally live in family communities? Are they fairly solitary or are they communal? Can you just give us a tiny bit more background on them? And also, what do they eat?
Okay.
And why are they near Nantucket? What's so special about that island going back 1,000 years or 5,000 years? Is it because there's a whole bunch of tiny fish they eat? I mean, sorry if these questions are stupid.
No, I'm happy for you to give me the framework. Let's start with what do they eat, because that draws the whales here. They eat something called copepods. It's plankton, microscopic little shellfish. And they're here because the copepods are here. The ocean geography here is called the outer continental shelf. And so it's that physical makeup of the shelf that is conducive to the growth of the copepods. And so that's why they are here. They give birth to a single calf, and I believe they only give birth every couple of years or so, you know, not even, I mean, it's a fairly long time between, you know, their ability to give birth. Also, because the whales are dealing with all these increased stress in an already industrialized ocean, the females have lost weight, they're underweight. And because they're underweight, they're giving birth less often. Trying to think of any other questions, Derek.
The other question was: do they live in family groups usually? Do they like how many whales will usually hang out together?
You know, I'm not sure. I can't answer that question. But they are found in aggregates. You know, groups, pods. They are seen singly. It's a very vast area we're talking about. You know, it's a 1,400 square mile area, and where they're found, and so they're only observed if somebody's looking for them. And honestly, the outer continental shelf is not that well studied. They have to really get out with their spotter planes to look for them. Very difficult to see because they're black. They live under the surface of the water. They have no dorsal fin. They only come up for short periods of time to feed. So, you know, not much really was known about them until 2010, which is pretty amazing because they started our whaling industry in the 1700s.
So the next question before, And you can, you know, if I ask a question, you want to go a completely different direction, feel free to ignore the question and go there. But the next question is, it seems awfully stupid to make a test area in the nursing grounds. If you're going to test something that you don't know what effects it will have, it seems that you would want to do that in a place that is less critical to a critically endangered species.
Right. Also, the Endangered Species Act, which is one of the most significant laws, environmental laws in the history of our nation, prohibits this kind of activity. And they're one of the most critically endangered animals on the planet. So it is a bit crazy. And, you know, it's not just the endangered whales. They're not the only endangered whales. There are three other species: the sei whale, the fin whale, and the sperm whale are endangered and found in these waters. Four species of sea turtles. Our piping plover migrates through there, our roseate tern. They're all going to be impacted. The Atlantic sturgeon, all these endangered animals will be significantly impacted by this construction. It's an industrialization. It is taking a soft natural seabed. It's such a rich biodiversity that it supports, and it transforms it into metal, concrete, high voltage electrical cable, and rocks. And the construction will last from anywhere from 8 to 10 years at least.
And I'm sorry if this is going away from your area of expertise, but you mentioned Atlantic sturgeon, and I've known some sturgeon. And I guess I didn't know them that well. I didn't know sturgeon went to the ocean. I thought they were more lake and river bound. But is this actually in the ocean? And does it come up? I mean,
apparently yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'll have to look up more about them. Okay. So let's talk more about. Oh, one more question before we dive more into the horrors of industrialization of the ocean and industrialization and industrial wind energy, which is like the Forest Service or Fish and Wildlife, or what are those called? Those are called agencies. What federal agencies are supposed to be overseeing this?
Okay. Fisheries. Really, is charged with the protection of our endangered marine life. All right, and that's under the Department of the Interior, and also the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is the permitting agency and regulatory agency for these kind of projects.
Okay. Okay. So, tell me more about the potential harms and the processes of industrial wind energy development.
Lisa, do you want to take that?
Jump in on that? Sure. So what we're dealing with, Derek, is the wind industry. The wind energy industry has been building a large amount of wind here in the United States onshore. And so we have roughly 130,000 megawatts of operating wind turbines in the country. That translates to about 65,000 turbines. And it's more megawatts than we have nuclear power at this point. And we're losing our nuclear power plants as we're building more and more wind. But the impacts, particularly with the environmental impacts of onshore wind, are significant. And I'm sure your listeners, by and large, are not aware of just how harmful these massive towers are, and the habitat degradation. When you're building these massive towers, you're building access roads to them. These are animated towers spin blades in area, take up airspace larger than a football field. People are not happy about these turbines. But for the environmental movements, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But so what was happening is increasingly more and more people were becoming upset about turbines being built close to where they live. So it wasn't, we tried to make the case that there were environmental impacts, but by and large, the environmental movement has stood solid in the camp of building more wind. It's all about renewable energy. We need to resolve the climate issues, and the environmental movement has decided that the only, the gold standard for solving the climate change issue is by building more renewables. So to make a, we did not fight the environmental move. It was very difficult to fight the environmental movement. Let's just put that out there.
Well, I want to say one thing, which is V.R. Keith and Max Wilbert and I wrote a book that came out last year called Bright Green Lies. And one of the central parts of it was that at one point, the environmental movement was about protecting wild places and wild beings, but it's been co-opted, destroyed, transformed into supporting this destructive way of life, including at the expense of wild nature. So that nowadays you have, essentially, it has become a lobbying arm of a sector of the industrial capitalist system, as opposed to lobbying to protect polar bears, right whales, etc. Anyway, so I'm just saying I agree with you. So that's all.
Yeah, and I didn't read your book, but I read excerpts from it and read the reviews of it. You are absolutely right. And it's been in a very difficult situation because I come from exactly the world you come from. We were like, protect our open spaces, protect our natural environment, protect the wildlife. And all of that is out the window because from the perspective of NRDC, the Natural Resource Defense Council, Sierra Club, you know, the whole gambit of large national and international environmental groups, climate change is the more serious problem than anything else. And that the wildlife will not be able to stand up against climate change. So, you know the arguments. I'm sure
so
you're
we have totally to destroy right. The village in order to save it.
That's exactly where we're at. And so onshore, we tried desperately to fight the environmental movement. I mean, they're enabling all of this development. And the wind guys have successfully cloaked themselves in the green patina. You know, we're a clean green. We're in lockstep with the environmental movement, and anyone who stood up against it was like, our voices were NIMBY, you know, not in our backyard. We were just dismissed. So, but the reason, so what, that's a long way of explaining what happened was these turbines started getting built closer and closer to where people lived because that's where the transmission lines are located. They, you know, the population centers, not big population centers. And you're not going to build these turbines near New York City, but at least enough population where you have transmission lines. So, and people complained, the politicos listened and felt that they solved the problem by, we'll just push it all offshore. You won't hear them. You won't see them. There's nothing out there. You know, it's like people who say there's nothing in the desert. We could just, you know, build all sorts of power, you know, renewable energy projects in the desert, which is, because there's nothing out there. Well, actually, our deserts are very alive, as are ocean waters. And so that became the talking point. Let's just build offshore. And the first wind project to be proposed was the Cape Wind Project, which was proposed to be built inside Nantucket, within Nantucket Sound, which is, if you know the area around in southern Massachusetts, that's the area that is basically a water that federal water surrounded by state waters. It's just this one area that is essentially surrounded by land, like to Nantucket Island, which is where Mary lives, Martha's Vineyard, which is west of Nantucket Island, and then the mainland. And that project failed for a lot of reasons. The biggest one being that it ultimately came down to cost. But that left such a bad taste in everyone's mouth. It's like, we can't let this happen. We're going to solve the planet, solve the problem of climate change with offshore wind now. Won't bother anyone. It's further away now. We'll build it further away from Nantucket Sound. put it into the open ocean, which is where, so now this project that Mary's talking about, it's called Vineyard Wind, proposed by international energy companies, not US based, to build 800 megawatts of wind south of Cape Cod. And so that's where we're at. We're going to be, the intent is to start with that project. And ultimately, under the Biden administration, he wants to build 30,000 megawatts of offshore wind from Maine to North Carolina. I mean, we're talking many hundreds, if not thousands. These are huge turbines. They're 12 megawatt turbines individually, as opposed to what's on land. It's typically averages between 2.5 megawatts piece per turbine. So very large turbines standing 1,000 feet tall, massive. And they're about being built about 15 miles offshore. So the conflicts between the environmental conflicts between wildlife that lives out there, wildlife that flies through there, and fishing, navigation, air navigation, so much happens within our coastal waters or over our coastal waters that the impacts of this are going to be huge. The impacts on the environment are going to be devastating, bottom line.
So I want to hear more about the specific ways that the wind turbines will harm wildlife, both above and below the water. And my loyalty is always to wild nature, but mm-hmm. I do want to ask one question about humans first, which is, what do the people who make their living fishing think about all this? Are they on your side or are they not on your side?
Totally on our side. Now, there are two groups of people that fall into that category. They're the recreational fishermen, and then the commercial fishermen. The recreational fishermen, I'm not sure if they go out that far. I mean, Mary, you may have a better sense of that. We hear less from them, but the commercial fishermen.
They use that area. They've been told, you know, the greenwashing, that these turbines are going to create an artificial reef and their recreational fishing is going to be better than ever. And there's no evidence to back that up.
And then from the commercial perspective, commercial fishermen are suing. So there are several lawsuits that have been filed against this wind project for multiple reasons, environmental reasons, particularly with regard to the North Atlantic right whale, failure to follow NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, with regard to fully evaluating the impacts of this project, this proposed project. It's not proposed, it is now permitted. And then the fishermen certainly are, the issue with the fishermen is that the wind company, the conflicts between where they fish and the amount of space that they need to fish and the location of the turbines, the wind company has negotiated, at least with BOEM, the Bureau of Energy and Ocean and Energy Management, that they would separate the turbines by 1 mile. Okay, so they in one, if you imagine this is a grid of turbines, so it's a X number of grid turbines in one direction by Y in another direction. So it's basically a large rectangular area. They're going to separate about 1 mile from each other in one direction. And depending on the project, it's anywhere from 0.8 miles to 1 mile separated in the opposite direction. That's not enough space for commercial fishermen and their nets to get through. And they're just like the conflict's too great for them to be able to, they are convinced it will put them out of business and at least make this entire area off limits for commercial fishing.
So how will this, can you get more specific about how this project will harm various species? And please include whales, fish, bottom-dwelling creatures, and birds, and anybody else you want to. But those are the four main categories I'm seeing.
Okay. I can answer that a little bit, Derek. So the whole issue here is these impact studies have not been done. It's on the onus of the developer and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management to do these impact studies. And what we learned was the impact studies that they presented to us were either out of date, from the wrong location, or incomplete. And so that's what Save Right Whales Coalition, my group, and Lisa, is asking for a moratorium on these offshore wind projects until these impact studies are done, you know, in compliance with NEPA law. They gave us a table that of potential impacts, you know, they're kind of guessing that they'll be moderate for whales, birds, sea turtles, fish. And they say moderate means a measurable decrease in abundance. But they're called moderate because the projects are temporary, because after 30 years, they'll be removed. And so there is absolutely no studies to back up those statements. And also, when do we accept that moderate, that it, under by that definition, is even acceptable?
Yeah, Derek, Mary's exactly right. And I just want to take that a little bit further. What, here in the United States, what we have done is we've looked out and we said, well, Europe has all sorts of offshore wind operating. Let's look at the UK has about 10,000 megawatts of offshore wind operating. If they can do it, we can do it, end of story. But the reality is, there was testimony before the House of Lords as recently as March 2021, last year, where the question was asked by one of the representatives or members of the House of Lords, said that they were, basically, here's the question. If we do not have evidence of how effective the mitigation techniques are for addressing environmental impacts on wildlife, then how can we possibly understand what the impacts are? If we don't understand what the impacts are, how can we mitigate for them, bottom line? And that what's true in Europe is true here. We have no idea what the impacts are going to be. And the wind industry, while they won't directly admit this, they're working with the environmentalists who are saying, we do not understand what the impacts are. We need to build the project, test the project, observe the project. And from that, we will understand what mitigation is necessary that we can put into effect in subsequent projects. So basically, and they have said that literally about the Vineyard Wind project. I mean, this is right out of direct quotes from, in this case, it would be the New England Aquarium, researchers that work at the New England Aquarium. And that's what Mary said, this will be a test bed. Vineyard Wind will be an 800 megawatt operating wind facility, will be a test bed to understand what the impacts will be on the North Atlantic right whale and other species. It's a shocking position to take when you're dealing with endangered species.
Yeah, yeah. So first, I don't agree with turning any area into a sacrifice zone because somebody already does live there. But again, you could rationalize this. Again, I wouldn't agree with it, but you could rationalize it if the area was only filled with completely abundant species whose populations are globally rising. Then you could say, well, then you could at least make the argument. But when you have 70 breeding females, this, and I'm sorry that I'm, you know, lecturing instead of asking questions, but this makes me so angry.
Yeah, thanks for affirming that. Thanks for affirming that, Derek. I go from angry to crying, really.
Derek, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mary. Sorry.
No, I'm saying it's so unbelievable. But one thing I wanted to say about this local test bed, because it's in the migratory routes of birds, bats, sea turtles, fish, whales, it's not only going to affect this local area, which happens to be 1,400 square miles, what they say, local impacts, which is unbelievable. But not only that, it will affect ecosystems throughout the world, really, because these are species that are migrating. So it's not just local impacts that will be, you know, that we need to consider here.
And Gary, I'm sorry, I just want to jump on to something you were talking about, and Mary, the wind industry on the onshore side of things has always taken the position that, and this is their fallback, as long if they're going to cause mortality of any species, their position was that as long as the impact was not felt on with regard to the global population of that species, then there's no problem, right? We may kill off all the local species that are present in the project site, but there's a global population, and let's acknowledge that. Well, we're talking now about a global population of under 360, 330 right whale, North Atlantic right whales. We have a direct impact. You would never see onshore an attempt to get an incidental take permit or a harassment permit authorization on a critically endangered onshore with regard to an onshore project. And here we are offshore saying, well, we could do it. It's not a problem. It's this is why there's a lawsuit that has been filed.
So. Say again go through the different species and you know, make this pretty basic. Go through some different species, how this could potentially harm them. Like you've said that migratory birds or the birds are flying through, and you know, we always hear from the wind industry, and this is of course completely bogus, but we always hear, oh, there's not very many killed by hitting the turbines. And so go through a few different species or a few different types of creatures, how this could potentially impact them.
Okay.
No, damn it. I'm not going to use the word impact because that's just wrong. That's just bureaucratic speak. How this will harm them. Harm is the word we're looking for.
Absolutely. Well, let's start off with the critically endangered North Atlantic right whale. The pile driving is an incredibly loud noise, and their hearing is very sensitive. And so if they're close to this activity, it has potential to deafen them, either permanently or temporarily.
Do you happen to know the decibels on this?
It's a low frequency. Well, no, I don't. I don't happen to know the decibels. Easy to find.
The turbines, if you're up close and personal with them, they're producing upwards of 106 decibels or better. I mean, let me just step back. Onshore turbines are producing decibel levels up at the 106 to 107 decibels. Not sure where the offshore are, but they're bigger and they're going to be louder, and their noise, that's what's happening at the nacelle area, which is up at the top, where the turbine is, but then the noise is going to propagate further out, and it's going to be very loud, and it propagates further in water than it does in air.
And just for reference, what is 106 dB? Do we know? Like, I think a loud rock concert is 120. Is that right?
Yeah. If you are living in 106 decibel world, you will go deaf. You will have damaged hearing.
I remember. Okay. A lawsuit many years ago in which they were doing the seismic testing underwater, and some environmentalists were suing against it. And one of the things that the environmentalists wanted to do to make clear how loud the thing was is they wanted to bring in air horns that were, they wanted to produce that sound in the courtroom itself. And the judge disallowed it, of course. And had they produced that sound in the courtroom, it would have deafened everyone in the courtroom, and it would have broken out all the windows.
Oh my gosh. They're over, you know, the wind company survey vessels are over the whales right now, today. They're mapping the seabed floor of their habitat in preparation for the construction. And Lisa, I think you were talking about the operational noise of the turbines.
Yes, I'm not talking about, you're absolutely right, not the construction.
Right.
Which is
louder. Right. Like the construction is, you know, loud pile driving, but also they'll be blasting the seabed. There's, they have to detonate ordnances out there from World War II, I think, or testing. And so they have to, they don't know how many there are. They have to find them and then they have to detonate them. And so that's, you know, an explosion. They have to liquidize the seabed floor so that they can lay the cables down because they want to bury the cables. There's a cable that connects each turbine to each other and then the turbines to an electrical service platform. And then there'll be a lots of cables from the wind farms to the mainland itself. And all of these cables emit electromagnetic energy. And so the four species of sea turtles I mentioned migrate by that magnetic frequency sensory ability they have. And the four species are the leatherbacked sea turtle, the loggerhead sea turtle, Kemp's Ridley sea turtle, and the green sea turtle. And so they don't know how this electromagnetic frequency is going to affect their migration. If looking at the wind lease areas, a map, you know, it's this massive area that spreads from Nantucket to Block Island to Long Island to Rhode Island, 1,400 square miles, and it's sliced up into eight different slices, which were leased off to different wind companies. And so when you look at the whole array, it actually is perpendicular and creates a wall against across the Atlantic Flyway, which is one of the major migratory routes for birds in North America. And one of our endangered bird, the piping plover, they did a federally commissioned study. And they found, they put little transmitters on their backs, they glue them between their little shoulder blades, and they track them. And they found that their migratory routes will go through the blades of the turbines, where ironically, we shut down long expanses beaches here so that they can nest and breed. But we're going to kill them before they get here. And there's the roseate tern, which is an endangered bird that will be migrating through those blades.
And just so we're clear, when these blades are rotating, the tips can reach over 100 miles an hour.
Right.
And these birds did not evolve to be able to detect.
No. As a matter of fact, because of the lighting, you know, they have to have red, you know, blinking lights on them for aircraft warning. And they say they're going to use red lights. Those red lights will only turn on when there's an aircraft above them. But I've yet to find an offshore wind farm in Europe or anywhere that uses these lights. And I do know Block Island, which has five turbines in the water off their island, they were promised the same lights and they ended up with strobe lights day and night, every day of the year. So birds are attracted to light during their migration. They migrate at night. They migrate in the same winds that turn the blades. They want a tailwind. So they choose the optimal windy conditions for their migration. They, you know, we're very susceptible to fog here. We're called the gray lady because we're socked in with fog often. And so during bad weather and fog, the birds are even more attracted to lights.
So this is breaking my heart, but I want to go back to one thing you said a while ago that, and you said they liquefy the ocean floor.
Right.
And so what this means is anybody who lives on the ocean floor is going to be obliterated.
Exactly. Everything will be obliterated.
Like
unless they can flee out of the way quickly. But
they don't know it's coming.
No. I mean, it's so silly. They assure us with these mitigation measures that, you know, they're going to use. They say they're going to like make a few pings of the pile drivers to scare the whales away. But there's no evidence that that will scare the whales away. And, you know, if they're feeding and they're here because they need to eat and they're hungry, they're going to put up with those little pings to scare them away. And then supposedly they say, well, they'll avoid the area for that time of pile driving and they'll come back. Well, the whales don't know that like lunch hour is done at one, and, you know, they can go out and then have a long lunch and then come back at 1 o'clock. You know, it could permanently displace them from an area that is really critical for their survival because it's supplying them with the food they need. They say they're going to shut down the pile driving, you know, that they're going to look for the whales. They're going to have observers on the sterns of the boat with binoculars looking for the whales. But any kind of chop on the water, they're not skimming out above the water to be seen. You know, they're under the water, they're black, they have no dorsal fin. And so it's really unrealistic. And they said if they detect an animal nearby, they'll stop the pile driving if it's technically feasible or practical. And they leave that totally up to the discretion of the developer as to whether they are going to stop this pile driving. And so the whole thing, Derek, is construction of these wind farms right now, the ones off us, are totally unregulated. They're letting the developers choose their own regulations. They're letting them to self-monitor, self-report, and self-mitigate.
That has traditionally worked really well.
Right? No, it's just a disaster.
If I could just jump in with regard to the birds, because it's a very serious problem. And it's not just the birds, it's the bats as well. Bats do fly over the ocean much more than people realize. And, you know, and they've been recorded as far as 60 miles offshore. So it's, and the birds go out much further than 15 miles. It's not far from the mainland. But the issue is, at least onshore wind, there's been enough of a cry that if there are endangered species known to fly through an area like the whooping crane or others, they've had to put spotters out there, and they, you know, where they're actually going out and observing whether or not a bird of protective nature is coming through. They may turn off the turbines, or they'll put radar systems in place to look for what the presence of a bird flying through or flock of birds flying through. Nothing like this is being proposed for these offshore facilities, number one. And number two, there is nothing, no way we can know with certainty that a bird has been killed by these turbines. So in the Vineyard Wind case, Vineyard Wind is required to report to the federal government on an annual basis. I mean, okay, annually, whether or not it observes any dead carcasses, any dead birds on the foundations or vessels, work vessels within the area, period. That's as much work of how we're going to understand whether there's mortality.
Okay, wait. So that's if it lands on the platform itself?
Correct.
Have these people never seen a baseball game? You know, when the turbine hits the bird, it knocks it. I mean, it hits a home Correct. Run. I mean, this is absolutely insane to attempt even to count. I mean, that'd be like if you did it on the land and you put a little square, like, okay, so you're out there with a pickup and you only count the birds that actually land in the bed of the pickup.
Onshore, that we're constantly fighting with the wind project owner what the methodology should be for searching for carcasses, but at least we know it's going to fall. You know, they always want to shorten the distance. We only want to look within a few feet of the turbine. When you're absolutely right, it's going to knock that turbine, that bird, much further away. or if the bird gets injured and crawls away, you're never going to find them. So,
or gets eaten by a coyote, you know.
That is exactly right. If you're going to go out there and survey once a week, you know there's going to be, scavenging, and you're not going to find the bird. But we have nothing like that offshore. All they're doing right now is going purely on probabilities. They're making an estimate of how many birds are likely to fly through the rotor-swept area of the turbine and what its likelihood of being hit. And that's how they're estimating what the mortality will be. That is not helpful. We've repeatedly found that a prediction of mortality is not informative as to what the ultimate mortality will be, period. And yet, here we are. That's what they're trying to do with offshore wind. With bats, they're going to be looking for bat carcasses, but that's all they're required to do is just report it. Same with the wind, with the birds, just report. I doubt there'll be any mitigation ultimately imposed on them.
I'm sorry.
I'm just saying it's a terrible situation.
So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. And so a couple things. One is, if you want to talk about anything, which I've not given you the opportunity, and also how do people get involved in attempting to stop this atrocity?
Actually, if I could talk about the first part, and maybe Mary could take the second. The one thing that I want to make sure everyone realizes is that the reason Mary and I are working together, I mean, I've been involved with the wind debate for a long time, but she and I and others have come together on this issue because the environmental movement, not including, I mean, the NRDCs, the Sierra Club, the Conservation Law Foundation, and National Wildlife Federation, all of them, are in lockstep with the wind companies now. They are literally formed alliances to promote offshore wind. And there's no question money is flowing to these environmental groups to support these projects getting built as quickly as possible. The imperative to them is resolving the climate change issue. And if I could quote from that, the House of Lords testimony, this one professor from the University of Plymouth said that if we're to follow the precautionary principle with regard to wildlife, all of this needs to stop. Offshore wind needs to stop now. And as opposed to what the environmental movement is, they've taken the position that climate change is the crisis and they need to do everything. They need to build every turbine as quickly as possible and get it going, before more damage is done to the planet.
And
we're in a terrible situation now.
I just want to add that Jevons' paradox and other things make it so, and we explore this in great depth in the book. It's all crap anyway. Yes, global warming is terrible. I'm not saying that's not. But wind energy doesn't actually help because it adds on. It has not actually reduced fossil fuels measurably. This is all complete nonsense. Wind, solar, etc., add on to the top of fossil fuels. They are not replacing them in a measurable manner. Fossil fuel use is greater than it's ever been. And so this is a false dichotomy. I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at the environmental organizations because this whole thing is just a lie.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I wish I had met you 10 years ago.
I wish I had met you too. So how do people stop it? What do people do?
Okay,
somebody's listening to this. They live in New York City. They live in Atlanta, Georgia. They live in New Brunswick.
Right. Well, my group, Cape and Islands Wildlife Conservation Alliance, you can contact me through the website capeislandwhales.org. That's capeislandwhales.org. If for more information, we need a lot of help. We need people with courage and talent and creativity because this is impacting people all over the country on both coasts, potentially, in very different ways. And so, but Yeah. Contact me through my website.
And to adding that as well, the politicians in this country believe they've stopped thinking about what the solution should be. They've just decided, you know, they have the endorsement of the environmental movement to move forward with all this offshore wind. If anyone's listening and wants to do something, we need the public to stand up and say, you should not see right whales be put to death or sent into extinction on our watch because of the desire to build offshore wind. It is a situation that has to be stopped, and they can help the public just by using their voices.
That's right. Yep. I mean, I know our area, Cape and Islands legislators, our representatives, they're saying the wind farms are overwhelmingly supported by the residents. And I don't believe that's true because I live here and I know many, it's been so suppressed in the news. They don't even know what's going on. And let alone that, they're horrified when they hear the details. So we have a big summer ahead of us. Because this is dire. This is dire. They've been two wind farms have been permitted. One's on the way. We're close. You know, they'll be starting construction. They've started construction on the mainland already, but they'll be out here with the pile drivers pretty soon.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Mary Chalk and Lisa Linnows. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.